Human Services Committee will come to order, and today we're going to have an interesting hearing. It's going to be over at 5 o'clock, so set your watches and be brief. Rick, you want to do a little overview here before we get started?
Thank you, Chair. Since we have so many people testifying, and I understand some people have brought in some written testimony, first I'd ask everybody to please turn off your cell phones and pagers. Secondly, when you do come up to testify, if you have written testimony, please have at least 7 copies of your testimony for our records. When you do come up, hand your testimony to Brittany over here, and she'll pass it out to the committee, and then sit down to testify, and please identify yourself when you do testify. If you have additional copies, you can give her all the copies, and she'll take anything left over and put it on the back table for the public. That is about it, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Steve March, would you come up, please? And Dr. Higginson, would you also come up? And you can share the table. Representative March.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate being here. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. I want to thank you for bringing forward this legislation at this time. The current state law relating to medical marijuana has some problems for both the user, those persons with a medical marijuana card, and for law enforcement. And I hope that the work that the committee does on this bill will bring all of those groups together and make sure it also works for the department, so that we make the law that was passed by the voters work more efficiently and effectively for everyone. And that's my primary reason, is to come here and support you moving forward with this bill in a form that makes sense for Oregonians, makes sense for medical marijuana users, and makes sense for the department and for law enforcement as well. So, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I'm here to support you in those efforts in any manner I can.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Dr. Higginson.
Senator Morissette, and
I'd like to go. Well, let me preface your statements for just a moment. Last session, it got toward the end of the session, and we didn't really have the time to get into this issue, and so I did ask that a task force be held during the interim, which it was, and Dr. Higginson was the moderator of the task force. And what basically we're hearing today, we're using his bill, which is, you know, kind of as a template to go from. Now, I know there are going to be amendments that people will present. In fact, Representative Floyd Pozanski has a couple of amendments. He couldn't be here today because his committee is meeting at 5 o'clock in Cottage Grove. So we will be gathering information, and then we will, I believe the next hearing is scheduled the 24th, and so we will come back in a couple of weeks and revisit the issue. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer for the Department of Human Services, and I think, as you all know, the department is responsible for managing the registration system for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. I do want to make it clear that this is not the department's bill. In fact, the department is neutral on this bill. I am here because I've been involved, as Senator Morissette said, in some interim work that has led to the development of some of this language. And in fact, last session there was a House Bill 2939, that was sponsored by Senator Cruz at the request of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Agency, and actually the Department of Human Services had some input on that bill as well. That bill passed the House. It did not go anywhere on the Senate side. There was a lot of controversy, differing opinions on that bill, and as Senator Morissette mentioned, because of that, he asked if I would pull together an interim legislative advisory committee to look at potential consensus legislative concepts for this session that we're in right now. So we did pull together that advisory committee. It included five representatives from what we considered the advocacy community for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, five representatives from law enforcement justice system, one patient advocate, one person from the Oregon Medical Association, and a couple of us from the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. And over a seven-month period in 2003 and 2004, that group met four times. Unfortunately, this was not one of my more successful advisory committees or task forces, and we did not come to a lot of consensus. In fact, there was only one issue that we gained consensus on, and clearly there was a lot of polarization and differences of opinions among the primary stakeholders, primarily between advocates of the Act and law enforcement justice. But it did provide, I thought, some really good discussion. We were dealing with a number of issues at the time that the committee were closed, and in September of 2004, I provided Senator Morissette with a report of that committee's work, and one of the pieces, one of the documents that came out of that was something that we called the draft straw man legislative language that incorporated a number of the ideas we had been talking about, and as Senator Morissette said a minute ago, it's that language that really forms the basis, the starting place for Senate Bill 772. The last advisory committee meeting that we had was on June 28th of 2004, and I had prepared that draft legislative language for discussion at that meeting. And we did talk about it at that meeting, and at the meeting it was conceptually adopted by the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act advocates. However, just prior to that meeting, we were notified by the five law enforcement justice system representatives that they really didn't think that we were going to be able to move any further forward in coming to consensus, and so they notified us that they were pulling out of the process and would not be attending that June 28th meeting. So they were not there, and since then have made it very clear to me that they do not support this language, and in fact I think that they oppose the bill, but they can tell you that themselves. Okay. The department, as I said, is neutral on this bill, and one of the main reasons is because we did not come to consensus and so did not feel like we had a product that we could push through channels for a decision. So that was the background leading up to the development of this language. And from my perspective, the bill does four things, and Rick Bacobian, the committee administrator, has provided you with a detailed listing. My comments are going to be a little more conceptual than that. But the first thing I think the bill does is allows more flexibility for medical marijuana grow operations. So instead of the current three mature and four immature plants that are available now, it would also authorize people to have seven mature plants or seven plants of any maturity level. It would also allow up to 28 plants at a grow site for people who are doing annual grows, and it also specifies that multiple patient grow sites for up to seven patients are allowable under the law. It also defines a seedling or a start to be something that is a less than 12 inches high or wide, and those are not considered plants at all. So that would not be considered as part of the seven. So the first part of the bill, and this is in Section 1, allows this flexibility for grow operations, and the compromise here was in return for this increased flexibility, the growers would register multiple patient grow sites, that the type of grow site would be indicated on the registration card so that law enforcement justice would know what kind of site they were dealing with, what kind of patient's grow site they were dealing with. And finally, the patient and the caregiver would not be able to assert an affirmative defense if they were found to have more than the allowable limits of the plants. So that was the compromise, more regulatory oversight for more flexibility. The second thing that the bill does is that it enables healthcare professionals who administer medication in the regular scope of their practice to be able to administer medical marijuana to patients who are in a healthcare facility. And the reason that this came up was that we've had at least one case where there is a patient who was confined to a nursing home. The nursing home was willing to allow medical marijuana use. The staff was willing to administer that, but both the staff and the facility were very concerned about liability issues. And so this would enable that to happen, but it would not require either the facility or a healthcare provider to do that, to administer medical marijuana, if they decided that they did not want to. It also has some prohibitions so that people are not going to be exposed to secondhand hand medical marijuana smoke as well. The third thing the bill does is it requires the department to develop a system where law enforcement justice system representatives can verify the status on a registered patient or a registered grow site 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This was the one issue where everyone came to consensus on. It is good for law enforcement. It is protection for patients and caregivers as well. It also specifies in the bill that law enforcement justice would have to identify who they are so we know who is accessing the data system, and also spells out that the same kind of confidentiality protections that we have to abide by in the program would have to be followed by law enforcement as well, so that when they get that, they have to get that information, they need to treat it just as confidentially as we do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Speaking of that, does this in any way come under HIPAA at all?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, this is something that we have looked at, and it is outside of HIPAA, one because we're a public health agency, but another reason is it's specified in the law that this is something that we would that we are supposed to be doing, and another thing is that we would change our forms as well to have informed consent release of information be part of the yearly either both the application and the annual renewal, so it's clear that patients are saying that this information can be provided.
Okay. Now, wait a minute. We have an AFZ in this building, which is an acronym for acronym free zone. So that's an acronym that you have to learn. So would you please explain HIPAA, please?
I believe HIPAA is health information Privacy Protection Act. I guess, Grant, what I was...
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What I was... I mean, you know, I mean, there's our judgment on HIPAA, and then there's the federal government's judgment on HIPAA. I'm just wondering if this had been... Because this is prescribing a drug, and it is a doctor-patient relationship... And I know we can read our law and say this falls outside. I was wondering if it had been vetted at the federal level to see if they had concerns.
Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz, we have not talked to the federal government about it. We have discussed this with our HIPAA. People within State Department of Justice and are convinced that we can work this out so it would not be an issue. And the other thing I need to say, too, is that the verification system is only a yes-no verification of patient name, caregiver name, or address. This is not something where they can access the database and have information on what kind of condition a person has or anything like that. So it's very limited to verification, but we have checked on HIPAA regulations, and we'll make sure that it complies with HIPAA law.
That was my concern, that it might be a backdoor entry into restricted information.
Right.
But, yeah, okay.
And then fourth and finally, the bill creates an advisory committee for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and basically this is something that we've been doing for the last couple of years anyway, but it codifies in state law that this is an important function that we need to have input from a variety of stakeholders in what the program does. And I'll just close by saying the bill does not have any fiscal impact on us. The 24/7 verification system that we are developing is something that we've already been doing. I think everyone knows that the program is totally fee supported, and there's enough cash balance right now to create that system. And then the other thing is that we've already been providing the staff support that we would need for an advisory committee. So again, there's no fiscal impact to the department. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Not on the testimony. There's a new product out of Mr. Do you know what it's called?
A new product?
Well, relative new to me. I just found out about it. There's
Sativac.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We'll have people come up here and talk about that in just a minute. We love the audience participation, but. Okay, thanks. So why don't you go sit down somewhere close?
that I can do, Senator Morris.
Don't leave the building. Please, don't leave the building. Brian Michaels, would you please come up? And is there anybody that you would like to bring with you? And I will call you and somebody else. We're going to kind of go in pairs here. Is there someone
okay.
you would like to have?
I don't know.
Nobody wants to? Yeah. Oh, okay. Good.
I should say Dr. Bear.
Dr. Bear. If you would identify yourself.
My name is Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney from Eugene, Oregon. I've been asked to testify here today largely because I've had the fortunate or unfortunate experience of representing many people charged within the Medical Marijuana Act in a variety of counties around the state. And what I've learned from that experience, one is, you know, what I tell jurors about the power of inertia is very strong even in people, that it's been illegal, it's been evil for so long, and the way we look at marijuana, it's just very difficult to turn our heads around so quickly because the law has changed. And what I found is that law enforcement, prosecutors, and even judges find it much more difficult than jurors to make this transition. It's probably because they've spent a good deal of their career putting people in prison, taking families apart, ruining lives over marijuana, and it's very hard for them to turn around and say, well, maybe in some contexts I was wrong. Jurors, on the other hand, represent the people who actually voted in this bill. And in counties across this state, some considered conservative, some considered rural, some considered liberal, and some considered urban, I have found jurors to be very, very sympathetic with people's medicinal choice, and that choice being marijuana. In that context, I want to give you some idea of how this Medical Marijuana Act plays out in the field, in the courts, so you can get some idea of what is working and what isn't working, what's awkward and what can be improved as we go through the court process. First, most of the affirmative defenses that I've represented are A, people who do not come from the recreational marijuana crowd. These are people who come from the typical medical crowd who are not recreational marijuana users and are unfamiliar with recreational marijuana people. They have discovered through one form or another, in one person, it was her mother who was dying of cancer, who had been given marijuana as a medicinal use for her cancer, told her daughter, who had been suffering for 5 or 6 years from a variety of illnesses, to try this, it really works. And her daughter did try it. She had no idea how to get a doctor. Her own doctor wouldn't sign it. So she was illegal. She got caught. This is your typical high school age children, family, middle class, never would consider breaking a law in their lives. She is now legal. She is now on the program. And there are sort of people like that. And I mention this because unmentioned by Dr. Higginson is a part of the bill I would recommend amending, which would be to increase the number of practitioners available to sign these cards, to include both nurse practitioners and naturopaths, each of which is allowed to prescribe other drugs in this state. With that addition, this form of person would have a much easier time finding a way to have someone sign their card. Because of the political downfall of certain doctors, many other doctors have now become even more afraid to sign these cards. And limiting it to that system limits the amount of people who could benefit from this otherwise harmless medicine. The other thing that comes up in a lot of these cases is, what's the definition of a plant? I had a case where dead plants, dead seedlings were counted. The jury, of course, acquitted that person in a very, what we would consider to be a conservative county, because they're very sympathetic with medicinal use of marijuana. But the case should never have gone to trial. It's the awkwardness of the language in the statute that causes these sorts of things to end up in court. So I would recommend that this committee amend the statute to define a plant, as Dr. Higginson suggested, while at the same time including some language that says, before a seedling becomes a plant, the seedling is also lawful to possess, because that's not in the proposed legislation. This would eliminate a lot of police officers coming to houses and not knowing what's legal and what's not legal based on these little seedling things. Are they a plant? Is it not a plant? The federal government has defined plant. The Oregon State has not. And this causes a lot of problems in the legal system. It just fixes a hole. That's all it really does. And lastly, I want to suggest to you that marijuana, because of this law, is in conflict with another law that the state of Oregon has. And that is, under Schedule 1, marijuana is now under Schedule 1. You may or may not know that methamphetamine and cocaine are under Schedule 2. Now, methamphetamine and cocaine have a recognized medical benefit, which is why they're Schedule 2. Marijuana has no recognized medical benefit, which is why it's Schedule 1. However, because there is a Medical Marijuana Act, as a matter of law, there is a medical benefit of marijuana. So as a matter of law, it should and ought to be Schedule 2. It is, what we call a conflict in law because of the passage of this act. So I would recommend that you amend this statute to fit into the body of Oregon law so that it, because it defines marijuana as having a medical benefit, becomes a Schedule 2, not to benefit marijuana smokers. And that's the same way, the fact that methamphetamine is Schedule 2 or cocaine is Schedule 2 isn't there to benefit the users of those drugs. It just clarifies the definition of the scheduling. And there's no reason why marijuana should sit alone when, as a Schedule 1 drug, when there's also an identifiable medical benefit. Otherwise, someone like me is more than likely to bring this to a court of law, sue the city on behalf of the state, get attorney fees, blah, 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 engage a whole lot of unnecessary litigation. It just seems easy to fix this hole at this level and to go through the judicial process. Other than that, I don't really have much else to say. I hope this idea of inertia can be offset as time goes on and we realize that the use of medical marijuana really is a benefit, and it's a new day for that. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I'm not sure the drug schedule is federal. I'm not sure how we in the state of Oregon change that.
The state of Oregon has its own scheduling. So you wouldn't bother with the federal scheduling. That would be what they use in federal court. In state court, marijuana is considered Schedule 1 drug. So that so it's where it sits on the felony line. So that manufacture of methamphetamine is a B felony, manufacture of marijuana is an A felony. Possession of methamphetamine is a C felony, possession of marijuana is a B felony. And so, those are just state schedulings. So we can, by virtue of a medical marijuana amendment, say marijuana shall hereafter be a Schedule II drug. It's typically done by the Administrative Agency Board of Pharmacy. That's what's charged by statute with scheduling drugs. But so far, the Board of Pharmacy has not caught up with the change in the law. You have that power to do that within the state of Oregon. Obviously, it will not affect the federal scheduling of marijuana.
Can you show me another instance in the drug schedule where Oregon is out of compliance with the federal schedule?
No, typically the Board of Pharmacy follows the federal schedule. This is an anomaly because Oregon does recognize the medical benefit of marijuana, and the feds do not. So as a matter of law, this is separate from all the other schedulings.
Okay, one more, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Have any other states that do medical marijuana or rescheduled marijuana?
As far as I know, and I'm no expert. I just learned today that Maryland has a medical marijuana law that I didn't know it had. So I'm certainly no expert, but I do not know of it occurring anywhere else.
Thank you.
Other questions?
My name is Richard Bayer, and I'm an internal medicine doctor. I practiced in Lake Oswego for many years. I was a chief petitioner of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act back in 1998, and I helped write the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. I participated in the legislative advisory committees and made every one of them. So I'm happy to present here. I want to thank the Senate Human Services Committee for allowing me to do this. And there's been some excellent summaries so far by Senator Morissette and Dr. Higginson and Attorney Brian Michaels. So this will help keep my testimony short. I just wanted to emphasize a couple of things that when Dr. Higginson mentioned it, Part 1 allows more flexibility for medical marijuana. But basically, this is a compromise to allow enough plants so that patients don't run out of medicine, but set the bright line that law enforcement indicated that they would prefer to have during the legislative advisory committees. So this is the compromise in that section. In another section, where the rule shall provide a plant has no flowers and is less than 12 inches in height and 12 inches in diameter as a seedling or start and not a plant. This standard actually derives from nursery professionals and asking them, where does a plant survive? If you want to grow 50 big plants, how many seedlings do you need? And most of the time, if it's less than a foot, there's still at least a 50-50 chance the plant could die. If it's over a foot, it's probably going to be a plant. And that's why the 12 inches was taken from the nursery community and saying, we know that patients aren't getting medical marijuana off of 2-inch seedlings, and we really don't think they should count as a plant. So how are we going to fix the law? And we think this is really important that we have some sort of a 1-foot rule, because patients are being prosecuted and little seedlings this big with a little tiny root coming out are called a plant, and we don't think that's fair. So I do want to emphasize that. On the 24/7 system, I want to emphasize that this is something that the medical marijuana program tried back in 2000 or 2001, 1999, several administrators ago. And actually, it was thought to be a good idea back then, but at the time, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program asked law enforcement to split the cost, and law enforcement didn't want to because they had other things to do with their budget. So I think that the patients have really made a concession this time by saying, okay, we'll pay for all of it because it does help both of us. And as mentioned, this is the part that we did reach consensus about, but I do want to emphasize this is all going to be coming out of the fees that a lot of these people that you see here that are disabled and on limited income are paying. So this money's not coming out of the sky. It's coming out of patient fees, and I think it is a big concession that patients are willing to pay for the 24/7 law. Other than that, I just wanted to state that, you know, we support Senate Bill 772, particularly in the draft that it was written last June. We're very appreciative for the Legislative Advisory Committee that Senator Morissette put together. We do seek a consensus bill on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and we seek to continue discussion in any way possible that the recommendations of the committee could guide us on how to reach consensus. And I think that what we're trying to do is make the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act work the best for all Oregonians. And that's what we're here for today. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. There may be questions as we move along.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And I did submit written testimony.
Okay, good. Chris Durbin and Craig. Oh, Craig. I'm sorry. Craig Durbin. Excuse me. Craig Durbin. Dewey Pat Patton.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am currently a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and serve as the Drug Enforcement Section Commander. My agency at this time is in opposition to this bill as it is written. However, I do believe that this bill can serve as a vehicle to include language that would be acceptable to law enforcement and the participants of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. I have had experience in enforcing the complexities of this law as a patrol officer, as a task force commander, and now as a program manager of the Oregon State Police. I have taught this subject throughout the state and served on the Legislative Advisory Committee that was convened by the Department of Human Services. I believe that the intent of the people at the passage of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act to provide those with maladies, which could be relieved with marijuana, the opportunity to grow, possess, and use marijuana. In an attempt to meet this goal, there have been serious flaws and misuses of the program that need to be addressed. These abuses have both placed the persons who are legitimately in the program and law enforcement at odds with each other, and at times can cause harm in both the medical and civil realm. Currently, problems exist, I believe, in the following areas. One is, as already been spoken about, is the cardholder. The inability to verify on a 24/7 basis that a person, in fact, is a cardholder, and this is causing problems with law enforcement. At the time of contact with the person, if it is after 5 p.m., basically what they will have to do, law enforcement, is to take the word of the person if they do not have the card on the person, or they will have to decide to take the marijuana at that time. This right now is leaving law enforcement in a quandary because at times they have to return marijuana based on recent court decisions or decide to hold on to it. If they decide to hold on to it, that can place them in a civil tort claim. Number of plants. The possession of the card now allows for 7 plants. However, cardholders can attempt to establish an affirmative defense that their doctors recommended more than the allowed 7 plants. I have heard as high as over 20 plants. This is a problem. There is not a clear, bright line that says enough is enough. Also, from my knowledge, doctors have no clear set guidelines that give a diagnosis that 7 plants is not enough. The reason I say that is that you may have one plant that produces THC levels of 4, 5, 6%, another plant that can produce THC levels as high as 20%. I've been on a task force. We see THC levels of 33%. So there's not a clear diagnosis in that area. Certain law enforcement officers at the direction of a district attorney of a respective county will pull the plants that are over the 7 plant limit and require the cardholder to prove an affirmative defense. Others will pull the plants because the cardholders exceeded the intent of the program and then charge the cardholder with manufacturing. And still others, excuse me, sir.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Craig. Would you describe or discuss affirmative defense? Would you talk about that for people who may not be?
Yes, sir. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, the affirmative defense is raised. There's a criminal exception to this program. And the criminal exception or the criminal means that if you're a cardholder, you are allowed to possess, manufacture 7 plants. There is an affirmative defense, however, that if a doctor, and again, a doctor, it's at a recommendation, and that is, it's not a prescription, it's a recommendation that you will benefit from the use of marijuana. So you're given a recommendation. The doctor can recommend more than the 7 plants. However, That's just an affirmative defense. If you go into the court of law, the district attorney, the person can bring up an affirmative defense saying that they needed more than the 7 plants. And that will be decided in the court of law whether or not they can prove that they needed more than the 7 plants. So that's an affirmative defense that they can bring up.
The recommendation is not a prescription. Is that the problem, that there is no clear authority or no clear sign that what would they have to show that they needed more than 7 plants? Would that be a letter from the doctor? Is that an anecdotal kind of thing?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, there is they on the recommendation, it recommends either how many more plants. On an average, it's been around 14 plants.
Okay. But what you're saying is that they may not have the letter in their possession, but they use that affirmative defense as a justification for having more than 7 plants. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. So what happens with that is that some district attorneys feel that the intent of the program is 7 plants. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if I have a narcotics officer in that house, if they're over that 7 plants, they're directed to pull the remaining plants and get them down into the 7 plants, and they will deal with the affirmative defense at the time of court. Okay. Where that leaves law enforcement is that we now have the extra plants. If they win in the court that recommendation holds, law enforcement will have to then give back those extra amounts.
Okay, and we'll get into the affirmative defense issue as we go along in this, so I just wanted to get that as public record, the explanation.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Another area is children at grow sites. Currently, there's no requirement that a grow site be secure from the possible entry of children into that grow site. There is no provision for use of marijuana in front of or around children. In the home of one person who grows marijuana and that person is not a cardholder, that person would be charged with child neglect. But if that person is a cardholder, they would not. There's no inspections. The Oregon Board of Pharmacy has inspectors that visit outlets that are licensed to distribute and possess controlled substances. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Program has no provision for inspections. A person can grow a controlled substance as administered to a person with a medical condition. This substance has no controls of how potent it is, what chemicals are used to grow the marijuana, what type is used, and the quantity administered. Is this grow site secure as a possible intrusion to by others? Is this grow site, in fact, located where it's registered to be? Imagine a person signing on with the state to manufacture a new drug without any control of any type, potency, prescription amount, the location where it's manufactured, and no inspections. There's no background checks. Currently, a person can come into the state from outside the state, have multiple convictions in manufacturing or delivery, sign on with one of the advocacy groups, and then become a cardholder for a patient or a caregiver for a patient. That person then, if they're in the program, and let's say that they're 10 pounds over the limit, and they become convicted of distributing or manufacturing a controlled substance, the longest that the program can revoke or suspend their card is 6 months, and they can be back in the program as a caregiver. Patients allowed to possess a card on probation or while they're on treatment. Currently, the judicial system is allowing some of the patients to possess the card while they're actually on probation or if they're in treatment. So what you have is a direct violation of one of the main directives of treatment. People will actually, and this is really causing problems in the probation and treatment realm, is you have some people sitting in treatment that are allowed to use a controlled substance and others that are not. The inability for law enforcement to determine both patient and caregiver location of the grow. What is happening is that if a law enforcement officer is informed that there is a house that has a grow in it, and they do what was called maybe a knock and talk or a visit on that house, and you have a cooperative person, either a caregiver or a patient, if that patient has 6 plants in that house, there's no way to verify that their caregiver, other than calling the program, and the program says that the grow site should be at that location, but there's no way to verify that the caregiver, in fact, is also not growing. Law enforcement believes that several things need to take place within this program that will protect a program that has a significant potential for abuse and harm. This program does need to have some bright lines established so both law enforcement and cardholders understand the intent of the legislature. This program needs to have all the ambiguities erased and controls put into place. You will hear about the success of the program, and there is a success, but this is very one-sided because no one in charge of the program is looking at what is happening at the grow site locations once those cards are issued. This falls on law enforcement. Currently, the way the program is set up, law enforcement and the judicial system may have many different views based on the county on which avenue to take. And I would encourage the committee to establish a work group to address these issues, at the very least to establish a mandated inspection program by the Department of Human Services. And thank you.
Thank you. My name is Dewey Patton. I'm a lieutenant with the Jackson County Sheriff's Department down in Medford, and I work at an interagency narcotics team down there called JackNet. Each summer in August and September, medical marijuana becomes an issue for us. In the last couple of summers, we've taken a pretty proactive stance at visiting growers and checking to see that they're in compliance. We get a number of calls each year about people are growing marijuana, but we call the health department, they're a caregiver, they're a cardholder, they've got their three plants, and there's no problem. And the plants are the reasonable size. And I'll refer to those as the Group A growers. But then we have the Group B growers that we look at each year. They are usually okay as far as the number of plants because they know they can have three mature plants, but they grow huge marijuana plants. I took one of the plants last year from one of the Group B growers, and just one plant that was typical of all those that we were seizing, and I took it to our warehouse and I hung it up for 2 weeks in September and dried it out, and it produced 8 pounds of bud and 3 pounds of leaf or shake marijuana. So, you know, while they can have their three plants and be legal, I know from the get-go that they're going to be way over in what's legally permitted to have as far as dried marijuana, where they're producing pounds and pounds. And I'm not trying to be funny, but that all disappears. It literally goes up in smoke, and we find evidence at their homes that they are selling it because there's tryptophan scales and baggies and marijuana residue, but no marijuana. And where'd it go? You know, they don't have to tell us. I mean, it's gone. We also run into this question over the 14 plant issue, and I don't know how 14 got to be the magic number, but, you know, 7 immature plants, 3 mature plants, but we run into people that they have a recommendation from their doctor, or it's on record at the health department that there's a recommendation for 14 plants. But is that 14 total, including immature plants, or is that 14 mature plants? Because 14 mature plants produce a huge amount of marijuana. So we run into that each summer, and quite frankly, last summer we just left scratching our head. We couldn't get a search warrant. We didn't really want to get a search warrant. We couldn't get a definition of why, and we just walked away from a couple that had their 14 plant recommendation. I'm going to keep my comments brief at that, and would entertain any questions if you have any.
Questions. Do you have some specific recommendations that would make this existing law work better?
Chair Morissette, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee. I believe that we do need to come to a consensus. We talked about this in the Legislative Advisory Committee. The reason that law enforcement walked away from the table was that there continued to be what we believed and what we interpreted a want for the expansion of these plants and these limits without a concession on the other end to have the affirmative defense, the choice of evils, those things removed. I believe that what we need to have is a very clear line as far as this many plants is what we're saying is enough, and any more than that, you're outside the bounds of the program. In the affirmative defense, the choice of evils, both of those need to be removed. That would be one recommendation. The other recommendation is the 24/7. We need to be able to verify at all times that the person, in fact, is a cardholder of the program. And there needs to be an inspection arm of this program. There needs to be the ability that the program is able to go out and regulate the grow sites, make sure that, in fact, that these grow sites are where they're supposed to be, how many plants that they're growing. And then the last recommendation is this issue of the caregivers, that currently a caregiver can come in with multiple convictions, become a caregiver, and then while they're in the program, if they're found to be convicted again of manufacturing, 6 months later, they're right back in the program. The caregiver is not a patient, has not shown a need for the medical marijuana. Therefore, the caregiver should be held to a higher standard, that they should not be allowed to be in the program if, in fact, they're abusing the program.
Regarding the definition of a seedling, I would suggest that they adopt the federal definition that already exists, which is if it has roots, it's a plant. And a seedling having to be 12 inches, you know, I've never gone to a medical marijuana caregiver or grower that was permitted six plants but only had five because one of the seedlings died. It's so easy to obtain another one or clone one that's not an issue.
Okay. What I'd like to do and what I have, tell you what I'm not going to do. We're not going to appoint another task force to try to come up with something in the next 2 weeks. What I would like to do, or what I will do, is ask that you submit in writing some recommendations, and I would like to have a work session that would discuss the recommendations. This would be a public work session that the board would have, the commission, or our committee. We would not be taking testimony, although we could open it up for some public testimony, but we would discuss this publicly. I don't want to go behind closed doors and have a group of us get together and decide what we want to do, and I don't want to have a full-blown task force because we're not going to have the time. So what we'd like to do is get the different proposals on the table and see how we can fit them in to come up with something that works, that people can buy into, hopefully, because otherwise I'm not sure we're going to be successful. I don't hear you saying, or what I do hear you saying is you want to make the program work the way it's supposed to work, is what I hear you saying.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good. I think everybody wants to make the program work the way it's supposed to work. That's what we're here for. And so we need to have input. Now, I know people came, and Stormy, you're going to be up next, and I know that people came with recommendations. Some of you have language. Some of you have amendments that you would like to be considered. And today we would like to collect those and then at some point relatively soon schedule a work session where we could come together, may not be the final work session, and try to put it together and just see what we can do. So this will be a lot of work in a fairly short time, but I think it's worth it. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Stormy Ray, would you please come up? Did you want to? Who would? Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, now we have three people who came over 100 miles, and we're certainly going to hear them today while we have some time. Yeah. And I know there are a lot of people who want to testify. I'm trying to get the testimony of those who have worked diligently, although some of you have worked diligently that I'm not calling on right now. But so this has been an ongoing discussion, and those of you who have testified have been involved in this ongoing discussion. Some of others may have been, but go ahead. Introduce yourselves, please.
Senator Morissette, my name is Stormy Ray. I am one of the chief petitioners for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act.
Okay.
And I have been a patient on this great program and an advocate of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Most of the issues and the concerns that this law and this program has been due to the lack of information. I think you'll find education and awareness has been a little on the slow side as well. The patients, their caregivers, even the officers of the law, the businesses, the state government, all have had a lack of information, and they have misconceived ideas of what this great law is. Even the individuals that have testified before you today had elements of their testimonies that I'm not sure they really understood. In fact, I heard questions. Where did this 14 come from? There has been so many people involved in this program that have done what they did for their situation, not always thinking of the patients and their need of this program first. For a lot of patients, including myself, in 1991, I would have no longer continued. If I had not had a friend who had known about recreational use that was willing to come and put a joint in my mouth when I didn't even have the strength to sit up in my chair, I probably wouldn't be here today. This compassionate act has been repeated thousands of times here in Oregon, with patients finding out what benefits this medical marijuana has and how it can help them with their relief and their discomforts. There's going to be many ideas of how to have the best possible tomorrow for our program. The one thing that I ask that you always look at is, where's the patient at? Will they be able to have the medicine they need? Or are they going to be thrown into a world that they never otherwise would have dealt with? Growing plants is not easy. A lot of us are very sick. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort. And our caregivers are very loving, caring people. The problem that we've had in the past has been, as this wonderful plant gets closer and closer to its harvest day, personalities start changing. People start looking at the medicine maybe a little differently because it can be made into ready cash so easily. What we need for this program, what I would ask of this committee, is that you help us not with more plants. We've learned to grow them bigger. But help us keep more of the medicine we're growing, so we can make it from harvest to harvest without having to become victims of finding somebody who's doing something that we don't want to be a part of in order to have medicine. Patients need this medicine. This is a wonderful, wonderful law. And I think we have the best program in the United States. But as other testimonies have already shown, we've already attracted a lot of unwanted attention. And our program is to the point where it could be abused very easily. So what I'm asking is for the program to be put back into the patient's hands. Give them back the control of their gardens. Let the patient decide where their patient medical supply bank is going to be. Why should we have to leave our medicine supply at a location with a caregiver who has no medical need for it, and it may or may not be there when we need it? Besides the difficulty of them bringing the medicine to us out at 1 ounce each time, we have a few problems with transportation. And in our proposal, there is a solution that would help all of us. But what we're really asking is not for more plants, but let us keep more of what we grow. We're becoming very good stewards at sharing our medicine with other patients. And most gardens will have an excess so they can help out at least one more patient coming into the program. We use the OMA Way system. And very briefly, what it is when a new cardholder comes into the program, it's going to be at least 2 to 4 months before they have their first harvest. During that time, patients that already have been in the program and have harvested have excess medication. It's not excess until their medicine supply bank is full. They have what the law allows them to keep in their bank. Anything over that is excess. We give it to each other. We ask those people to remember me. When they harvest, remember the people that helped you get to your harvest when you didn't have medicine. Ask them now, do they need medicine? And this way we can also get the different strains that we need for our conditions. Most people, when you think of medical marijuana, you think it might be one type. We have over 1,000 strains. I use 5 different ones to take care of my condition. One garden, that's an awful lot of work trying to keep all those different plants growing differently, because each strain has a little bit different characteristics, and you have to really pay attention to what you're doing with this medicine. It's not a weed. We don't grow it as weeds. We grow it as medicine. And it's not an easy thing to do. But anybody with some education, guidance, and a little bit of encouragement can have a garden out here. And it makes a world of difference for that person's life. I'm still with you. It's been about 10 years now. And without medical marijuana, I don't think I would be. The MS continues, and I expect it to. That's part of what I have. But I'm full of life, and I wouldn't be otherwise. So I thank you for all the hard work that you're about to do. This isn't going to be easy. But please put us together the best medical marijuana program in the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe a naive question. Plants can be grown productively the year round in a greenhouse?
But they have a life cycle. If you trick them and grow them inside, you can get 3, sometimes 4 harvests. If you grow outside in the seasonal cycle, you only get 1.
Okay. Life cycle.
And so we trick them.
Okay.
And I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Jerry Wade. I'm a disabled veteran. I've been in this program now for 5 years. I moved to Oregon because right after Oregon passed this law. And before I got here, I was in the hospital 4 or 5 times a year, usually 8 to 10 days at a time. Since I've been in Oregon and in this program, I have not been in the hospital one day. And my doctors at the VA back me on this program, even though it's kind of against their policy, because they've seen the help and what it's done for me. And what we're doing, and what Stormy was referring to, is we'd like to enter as suggestions the proposals that are being entered as House Bill 2693 on the House side. And what we've done is we've taken what we believe are reasonable compromises between law enforcement and the patients and developed a bill that I think will work for everyone. But what I'd like to start off with is a little bit of education, because most people, you have to understand a few things about marijuana plants and how they were grown to be able to make a decision or understand what we're going through. First of all, you need to understand the size of a marijuana plant has nothing to do with its maturity level. A plant can be 2 feet tall and mature and 12 feet tall and immature. It has to do with the light cycle and the environmental conditions that the plants are under. During the fall, when the light cycle or the days get shorter and they get down to 12 hours or less day, that's what triggers the plants in the fall to start maturing or to going into bud. So in indoor grows, what we do is the way our law is set up, where we're allowed to have 4 mature immature plants and 3 mature plants, that forces our program right now, or patients in this program, to have 2 separate growing rooms. You cannot have mature and immature plants in the same room. They have different light cycles. A mature plant takes you have to have 12 hours of complete darkness each day to cause a plant to go in maturity or bud or flower. If they're getting 18 hours of light a day, they will remain a vegetative or immature plant for as long as you leave it under that vegetative cycle or 18 hours of light. So what our current program does is it forces patients, you have to have 2 separate rooms to be able to grow. Very few patients have 2 separate bedrooms available, one of them that can be completely light tight with no light pollution whatsoever to be able to grow these plants. That creates a real hardship for a lot of patients on having a place to grow, because it's not just having a closet or a room, you have to have 2 separate rooms to grow. That's the first thing that you need to understand. And And also the plants, for a mature marijuana plant to go from seedling to the average size or age most patients are growing, is about 4 to 5 months of time. It's 2 to 3 months under the vegetative light cycle, where they're going to be getting 18 hours of light, and then they're moved into the 12-hour room, 12 hours of light cycle, and about 60 days later, give or take 10 or 15 days, depending on the genetics of the plant, that plant will be mature and full. Now, under our current law, we're allowed to have 3 mature plants, and we harvest 3 mature plants. The problem is, we're allowed to keep 1 ounce per mature plant when we harvest. And that number is ridiculous. It's not in compliance with what these plants will produce. On average, most plants, when they're harvested, are going to be 3 ounces. Now, that's not to say all plants. There are many patients that don't get that good, and that's mainly because they have inferior lighting equipment, they don't understand what they're doing and are failing if they get under that. But a knowledgeable grower with the right equipment and education can get 3 ounces plus off of plants. So if we have our limit set to 1 ounce per mature plant, as soon as our patients harvest, they're instantly out of compliance and they're breaking the law. And it also, we have to go into a little bit about how much patients use. Now, me and Stormy have been in this program, and like I said, I've been working with Stormy since I've been in this program about 5 years now, and I've talked to thousands of patients. Now, again, this is an average. I know patients that use 5 and 6 ounces a month that are in severe pain and go through that much, and I know patients in this program that use 1 ounce a month. But from what we have commonly ran into is most patients are in the 2 to 3 ounce a month range. And to harvest a plant, you can only have a harvest about every 2 or 3 months. So from harvest A to harvest B each time is going to be about 3 months, and most patients need 3 ounces a month, so that's about 9 ounces between harvests. And that's just that's actually just about average of what the patient's going to get off those 3 plants is about 9 ounces. But unfortunately, our law currently right now lets them keep 3 ounces. So a patient is forced, if he wants to stay in compliance with the law, has to give away 6 ounces of this medicine that he's grown, he's taken the time, spent months and months cultivating, and then run out in a month and go 2 months without any medicine. Hopefully somebody else will give him some of it back. And it really sets patients up to where the point where they're going to either go without medicine or they're going to break the law.
Jerry.
Okay.
This is probably an extremely naive question.
Okay.
It seems like with as much demand, legitimate demand there is for this particular medication, that there would be a commercial, regulated, controlled growing system that could produce the required amounts and make sure that it's available to people. Now,
and that's,
why doesn't that happen?
Well, that's what we would partially like to see happen with the... We have a provision in our bill which would basically have the health department contract with the extension offices and develop a program and a way for these patients to grow.
Okay.
That is in compliance.
Now, what I'm thinking, and I'm sure this has been discussed, but it just seems to me that if there is a controlled growing area that is secure and controlled,
mm-hmm.
and if people who legitimately qualify for the program should be able to be supplied in a legitimate as need basis,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me, and I don't know what the economics would be. You're paying for a medication,
mm-hmm.
anyway, so why hasn't that...
It still comes back to the federal Schedule I guidelines,
okay.
which you cannot have any, and under our current law, there can be no sale of marijuana. A patient can give marijuana to another cardholder
okay.
for no consideration, but you cannot sell the marijuana to anyone.
Okay, maybe what needs to happen, and there have been some suggestions of doing a study on the benefits of marijuana
mm-hmm.
as a drug, as a medication, and to do it as a prescription, and then to make it available on a prescription basis as a
again, it comes back, if a doctor prescribes a Schedule I drug, they will lose their license.
I mean, these are things that maybe
mm-hmm.
have to be fixed. But I mean, if you want to get away from the loopholes in the law of people growing and using various defense techniques and so on, it just seems to me that would be the way to go. Now, those are thoughts that I've had as I listen to the problems that you have in supply, mm-hmm. and I listen to the problems that law enforcement has with the other end of supply and the temptation that people have who are growers, mm-hmm. whether or not they will use it themselves or sell it, and so on. It's a very, very, very loose mm-hmm. operation. And so that those are things that I think we need to look at. Senator Strzok.
Yes, to either of you. Question is, you've talked about producing ounces of marijuana, mm-hmm. but there's an active ingredient there that is a medication.
Correct.
And it's been testified to that might vary from 4% to 30% within
Correct.
An ounce. That's a very different percent of medication mm-hmm. that you're getting from a product. You got 1,000 different varieties of plants.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are known to produce much higher quantities, I'm certain.
They came up with this problem back when they were doing the hearings for medical marijuana on the federal level under Francis Young, which is a DEA head administrative law judge back in the 80s. And what they came up with or determined is that marijuana is a very safe drug. An LD50 rating is where life death 50%. They give half of the lab owners enough medicine until half of them die, and it determines the toxicity level of medicines. Marijuana does not have an LD50 rating. It is physically and impossible to overdose. I believe the statement that they came up with, Francis Young, is you would a patient would have to smoke between 25 and 50,000 medical joints in a 15-minute period to reach lethal toxicity. And because this level is so much higher than the level where what a patient is going to be using, it is very safe for a patient to determine how much he needs. And also, you talk about the strength increasing on the marijuana. That is a very good thing. I myself have chronic bronchial asthma, and I use it as a bronchial dilator. And because of the strength that is up there, I can take one or two puffs off a joint or a marijuana cigarette, and that will give me the relief I need to go on for several hours, where if I have very poor quality, low THC level medication, I might have to smoke two or three cigarettes to get the same effect, which the smoking is the one weak link in our medication as far as the harmful that comes from actually smoking or bringing smoke into your lungs. And having a stronger medication allows patients basically to use less at a time or actually smoke less and still receive the same benefits.
Still begs the question.
Right.
You've got 10 ounces or 1 ounce of marijuana at 4% and one at 30%,
mm-hmm.
you've got a very different quantity of medication. I think as we address the issue, mm-hmm. we need to address the amount of medication rather than the ounces of a
That's true, because there's no way to determine what a certain marijuana plant. I can take the same plant, and if I give it, and grow one under perfect conditions, nutrients, thousands of watts of lighting equipment, and end up with one thing, and take a 400-watt light and poor nutrients and stick it in poor soil, and end up with quite a different type of medication. And so the limit, we're suggesting again, is not increasing the plant limit. But right now, it is obvious that when these plants are harvested, there's more medicine than an ounce grown off a plant. And right now, we have two choices. That medication can stay with the caregiver. The person has no medical need for that medication. And if this person's growing for 5, 6, 7 people, and he's holding all this medicine for all these people, this one person is setting on, a mountain of medicine, and then the patients get 1 ounce at a time, and oftentimes patients are even being charged for that ounce from their caregiver because they don't know the law. And in fact, there's a big disagreement right now as far as the program, as far as who owns the medicine. We say that the law clearly says, as far as we're concerned, that it's the patient that owns the medicine that's being grown, whether it's at the patient's house or the caregiver's house. It's being grown for that patient, and everything that comes off that plant belongs to the patient. The other people, there are a lot of activists in the room that are going to argue that because it's at the caregiver's house, the caregiver has control of it and there owns it. And we feel that is one of the chief ways that marijuana is being stolen from patients and diverted from the black market. By allowing the medicine after it's harvested to go to the person who has the medical need for the medicine, you would get rid of a lot of the diversion, because that person needs that. He knows it's going to be so long until he has a harvest, and he's going to hang on to it.
Okay. Now, let me ask a question of the cost of the card that you must purchase. What was the cost of the card to start with?
It has dropped from $150 down to $55 and $20 if you're indigent.
Okay. Now, is it against federal law? You can change the state law, but is it against federal law to receive? Okay, you receive the marijuana without charge. You can't charge for it, but could the cost of the card take care of that?
I don't. If the state wanted to actually get into producing and growing marijuana, but I think when you started doing that, the federal government would be such
a... Well, okay, I'm not talking about the state getting into it. I'm talking about the possibility of contracting with a grower to do that, and the cost of the card would make you eligible for the program.
Brings up another fundamental problem or misunderstanding about our law. Right now, the law says that a patient may engage in...
You're talking about the state law?
Yeah, our state law says a patient can engage in, and a caregiver may assist the patient.
Yeah.
The medicine belongs to the patient, so the expenses belong to the patient.
Okay.
It's his medicine.
Well, that is... Okay.
Okay.
If it's a state law, we can change the state law. Federal law, we have to take a look at. Now, I'm sure the feds don't like the state law anyway.
Right.
I mean, there are some federal people who don't like our state law. But it is the law of Oregon. And if we can figure out a way to satisfy law enforcement that doesn't have a lot of loopholes and allows people to grow and sell and so on, and addresses the problem of that Senator Starr was talking about, if possible. I mean, if you have a professional grow location with a professional grower, some of those problems may be solvable. But I know that we probably have about six or seven different solutions in this room that probably don't fit together very well. So what... even more than that. But what we're looking at is a way that, you know, if we can introduce some language that we can get through both houses and the governor signs and see how that works, it might change the basic structure of the program and evaluate it as we go along, because obviously there are some problems with what's going on right now. So... Did you have a question?
Well,
Senator Cruz.
More comments, I think, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And Stormy and I have been at this for a long time now, haven't we? And there's been growth. I would say, we've explored some... We explored the concept of the experiment station doing it. What we run into is... a land-grant college can't do something like that, and the problem, the main problem comes down to the federal government, and as long as it's a Schedule I, state law can be more restrictive but not less restrictive than federal law. That is the way it is. And so we're kind of in a box, and I guess, Mr. Chair, I think we can make the program better, and I would just like for Stormy to be able to not have to be here every 2 years, and
keep her young and active,
and enjoy her life. So that's kind of my goal in this.
Okay,
Mr.
Your goal is to make Stormy happy, right?
Yeah, actually.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
We have a few people who traveled over 100 miles. Al Haywood, would you come up, please?
Thanks.
Al, where are you? And John Sejo, Lotta Taylor.
Thank you, Senator. I believe in the old adage, there's no such thing as a short speech, and I'll try to adhere to that. I think you're on track to the solutions. I've been an investigative reporter for 50 years, and in page one, if you went to college and took a course, an investigative reporter, it says follow the money trail. Historically, after Prohibition ended in 1937, then Secretary of Treasury Morgenthau asked the FDA to ban marijuana because there was no tax income from it. The same U.S. Congress passed laws prohibiting the FDA from banning tobacco, even though 143,000 people died from use of tobacco. Why is marijuana illegal and alcohol and tobacco not? There's one very simple answer: money. Follow the money trail. The solution here is not a medical one. The solution is to make marijuana legal and control and tax it like alcohol and tobacco. Sooner or later, some state is going to have the courage to do that, and you all are going to be asked by reporters and your constituents why the people in the other states pay less taxes and have their programs fully funded from the revenue from marijuana and are not supporting a failed enforcement of the ban of it. So your solution is, in my humble opinion, and frankly I don't use marijuana or tobacco and very little alcohol, nor would I tell my family to do it, but they're not in pain. But the solution is very simple. Simply make it legal, control the growing, sales of it the same as you do alcohol and tobacco. You've already got the program set up there to do it, and that will solve the problem. And it's my conclusion that that'll happen. The state that does it first is going to reap an economic benefit. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Sejo. I have been the director of Voter Power since 1998. I was also chief petitioner for Measure 33, which was recently defeated at the November ballot. I was also a member of the Legislative Advisory Committee and have been working for many years on this program with patients. I have some specific comments on the bill and also just some general comments on the process. I think the Legislative Advisory Committee was helpful, and I think that the formation of some sort of ongoing forum for law enforcement and patient advocates to communicate is a positive thing for all sides. Let me say that during the campaign for Measure 33, I had the opportunity to debate a lot of these issues with members of law enforcement, and I understand their desire to have bright lines, and I think that is in the best interest of patients as well. The problem, I think, is that if we are going to draw bright lines, we have to draw them where they work. You've already heard extensive testimony. How about the patients only being able to have 3 ounces just isn't enough? I differ with Stormy and Jerry in that I think that the plant numbers are a little low as well, but I think the general idea of drawing bright lines would be good for everyone, but if we're going to do that, the lines have to be drawn in a way that patients can maintain an adequate supply of this medicine, and we're a long way from that. I think that there many patients and advocates will get up here and, you know, fight to the death for their right to that affirmative defense. And let me tell you why that is. Marijuana is medicine for people. It's a safe, effective medicine. And right now, the law puts patients in this terrible conundrum of have enough medicine to maintain your health or break the law. And let me tell you, there's very few people that, when they're faced with that horrible choice, will choose to go without their medicine. So you have lots of patients that fall through the cracks one way or another who need more medicine than they're allowed to, and they need the affirmative defense. There's also the other form of the affirmative defense is for patients who have not been able to get a doctor's signature, and there's a number of people in that category. I think that if we could find a way to make the limits reasonable and open up access by things like the earlier suggestion of adding nurse practitioners to the program, it might be possible to make the program workable and have absolute hard and fast bright lines, because I understand the difficulties law enforcement has faced. But if we're going to draw bright lines, again, they have to be at a place that works for patients. I'd also just like to make some specific suggestions. I think that one thing that could come out of this is that there's a lot of portions of this bill that don't seem to be controversial. I think everybody in the room agrees that we ought to go to 24/7 access. I haven't heard anybody objecting to the protection for licensed nurses helping a patient administer medical marijuana in a healthcare facility. I think that if we can move forward on those non-controversial elements, that would be a good thing for everyone. I would add to that list reciprocity. There's really no reason that Oregonians that, say, travel to Montana can't legally use their medicine there, and Montanans that come here. The Montana law that was recently passed by Montana voters does allow for reciprocity, so I think Oregon's law should add that, and I haven't heard any objections to that. And there may be other non-controversial things that we could do to improve this law, and I think we should do that. As far as specifics, I share the sentiment expressed earlier about coming up with the definition of plant. I was an expert witness on the case mentioned earlier. My estimate was that Washington County spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 prosecuting a patient who was acquitted, and it was all about the eight little tiny dead cuttings. You know, I think if there were a bright line, I don't think the prosecutor wanted to bring that case. I didn't really want to be there as the expert witness. The patient didn't want to be there. The law enforcement officers didn't want to be there. It was a big boondoggle for everyone, and if we could come up with some kind of definition for when we start counting plants, it would help everyone. Someone earlier mentioned that it's easy enough for patients to start. The problem comes in when a new patient comes into the program, and patients have been very generous and compassionate in helping each other out, but you have to recognize that any time a patient takes a few extra cuttings in order to help some new patient coming along, they are risking breaking the law. And so redefining plants so that patients could do what they're already doing anyway, helping new patients by giving them a few cuttings without placing themselves over the limit and at legal risk, I think would be a good thing for law enforcement and a good thing for patients.
We're going to have to... I want to try to get the rest of the people on the list, so...
All right, well, I'll stop my remarks there.
Well, what I would recommend is give us your...
I've submitted written testimony.
Okay, good. And we need specific the recommendations that you are making. We have in writing.
So. Yep.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lota Taylor, and thank you, Senator Morissette, for giving me this opportunity to speak. I am a new cardholder. I have just I haven't even received my card yet. Just my paperwork.
Okay.
And my doctor agreed to sign to try this for me because everything else was failing, and it was, I've had many surgeries on my spine, and I was on morphine for a year, and I finally got off, and I didn't want to go back on. My daughter suggested that I try this program, and in just the last 2 months that I have been using medical marijuana, my blood pressure is normal. I'm able to function and get up every day, and my pain is not stopping me from even walking out the door. And being a new person, a new cardholder, you're left out the door. You pay your fee. They can't tell you where to go. Your doctors can't give you any sort of suggestions. So your only source is to go online or ask anybody you might know that wouldn't be offended by you asking. And there's a lot of people out there that want to take your money. I think that doctors, caregivers, nurses, naturopaths, I think it's important that they have the right to also sign for their patients if they feel that it could help their patients. And I feel that doctors and those organizations should be able to hand out a list of organizations that people with cards can contact them and try to find a caregiver. Because usually the people that go on to the medical marijuana, it's because other things have not worked for them. And most people don't have the money to spend or the energy to drive or call around. And there's a lot of people that are bedridden that also could really benefit from milk marijuana. I'd like to talk about the crop failure.
Now, we're going to have to cut it short because we have about 10 more people.
Okay.
And we have less than a half an hour.
Okay.
So, thank you. Thank you very much. Who else is over 100 miles? Lindsay Bradshaw, where are you? Okay, if you're over 100 miles, come on up. And then we'll try to get everybody else in. But please, please keep it to 3 minutes, if you could. And we'll find you. Right, Rick?
Good. Who has a watch?
He's our
gentlemen, watch your watches, please.
Okay.
Senator Morissette, I want to echo Representative.
What's your name, please?
I'm sorry, Laird Funk. I'm from Williams, Oregon.
Okay.
For the record, I started the medical marijuana work in this building in 1993 at the cooperation of Senator Frank Roberts. And I'm just going to say, frankly, had we adopted that bill, we wouldn't be here today. It was one page. It had bright lines. It had 24/7. We'd have been happy. But we're here. So I want to thank you for the thrust of each part of this bill. Each part of this bill addresses something that needs to be fixed. I find in conversations with the people that are advocates for the program and advocates for the patient, there are a wide range of views as to how one might finish fixing each of these pieces. But I'm proud of the hard work that's been done by the number of people who've come forth and will be coming forth with solid proposals and provided written testimony. And I would personally, Senator Cruz, you would like to quit doing this. Again, I've been doing it since 1993. I'd like to have a life. Everybody back here, their patients a good part of them. They're taking medicine so they could have a life. And bless you, gentlemen, for coming to this building and making this part of your life. But for the rest of us, it's pretty foreign. And we'd like to go home, and I'd like to have the cops have a nice, clean job, and we have a nice, clean supply of medicine. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir. Introduce yourself, please.
Yes, I'm pretty hard of hearing, so I didn't hear what was said earlier, so if I'm redundant or anything. I'm Lindsay Bradshaw. I'm from Williams, Oregon. And I have a unique perspective on this in that I worked for a medical marijuana support group before I got cancer and had a kidney removed, an adrenal gland removed, part of my transverse colon, part of my pancreas, had an entire spleen removed, and 80% of my stomach. And they gave me up for dead twice on the operating table, and after the operation, I had gone from 161 pounds to 103 pounds. And they sent me, I didn't want to be in a hospital or an institution, to take my chemo for 6 months. I have a friend who's a retired MD. He's most likely my best friend, and his wife had worked in hospitals. And I did 6 months of chemo. I spent 4 months in bed, so I know what I'm talking about in pain. And I'm kind of tired of people using my pain as a political football. And the fact that we're 4 legislative sessions after this law passed in a landslide and still discussing about whether marijuana is more potent than it was 20 years ago, or all this other dangerous inanity, it really wears thin. And I see very little difference between what's going on with this issue than when I was in the civil rights movement in the late 50s, that they would say everything they had to say, but they would never admit that they didn't want black people to vote or go to school with their kids. They had all these talks, all the ways of avoiding the reality, all these things to refer to, everything except for dealing with the problem. And again, we wouldn't be four legislative sessions down the line talking about this sort of stuff if somebody wasn't trying to jam this law. This law passed in a landslide. Now, I would not have survived my chemo had it not been for a group of people called Voter Power. And I was 6 months, literally 4 months of that, unable to leave my bed. And my retired doctor friend told me that I was sent home after the operation to die, that they didn't think I had a chance of making it. And I was told by a half a dozen doctors that I took the amount of chemo I took better than any patient they had ever had. And the reason was because I was smoking. If I was conscious, I was smoking. And the first half of that, I was doing it illegally. And I don't want to sound corny or anything, but it was a good feeling to get that card in the mail to know what I was doing was legal. Mm-hmm. And everyone who's got one of those cards feels that feeling to a degree, I'm sure. And I think that if we wouldn't be talking about affirmative defense if, in fact, the last 5 years people have been demagoguing this issue. The reason we put affirmative defense in this law was because we knew people would be demagoguing the issue. If the issue wasn't being demagogued, we wouldn't need an affirmative defense. We'd be talking about other things. We'd be talking about how to get patients medicine, not how to stop them to get their medicine. And I'll take no more of your time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you for being here today. You drove a long way. Yes, sir.
Hey, my name is Tim Moles. I live in Sumter, Oregon. I was born and raised here in Salem, Kaiser, Eagle Scout. I joined the military in 85. I went to Desert Storm. I scraped out friendly fire. I come back home. And I ended up joining the Navy. I sent to Navy dive school. And I got rear-ended on a motorcycle and got rolled out of dive school. And 6 months later, I had to go back and finish up right where I left off. And with a back injury I've had for years, I've been jumping off piers around the world with tanks on my back. I've got severe back injury. I also have PTSD in 97 and off the coast of Haiti, a ferry boat sunk with 70 people on it. As a Navy deep sea diver, I went down and separated, untangled them, and brought them to the surface through team efforts of my comrades. Well, through a lot of this, I hit a wall, was diagnosed with PTSD from Bremerton Naval Hospital, was being medically discharged. I met up with a woman whom I thought we should get married, and that was a wrong mistake. I got attacked one day, and I responded, and I ended up going to jail, and I'm now here on probation from Washington State on interstate compact. I here in Marion County, transferring to Baker County. I have a medical marijuana card. I've done jail time over this. They've said it's illegal, that I have an illegal prescription. And they put me, I just got out of jail about less than 5 days ago, a week ago. They stuck me in a second floor on an upper bunk with no pain medication whatsoever. I put in over 4 kites for sick call, never got seen in sick call. I put in a grievance, never got heard on my grievance. For 10 days, I lived basically on a cookie sheet with a thin pad and a severe back pain. And it all because I have a medical marijuana card. And looking like I'm probably going to go back to jail over this again. So that's, just for what it's worth, it's put a lot of situations.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
I'd like to say just something for about 10 seconds. The growing and the procurement of this medicine really works better if it's done as a group project. Let's say a dispensary or a co-op or large amounts of people. It really does work better as compared to one person trying to do it.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else over 100 miles? Okay. Would you ladies like to come up? Maybe two of you at a time, if we can arrange the chairs. And then that gentleman. Uh,
two at a time.
And I'm sorry to have to limit the testimony, but we want to get everybody in. Everybody who came to testify will have an opportunity.
I'm Angelique Jekyll, and I'm a proud patient, medical marijuana patient for 4 years, and a proud volunteer for the OMA projects.
Okay.
I am hospitalized very frequently. I have lupus, diabetes, and I have a digestive system. I cannot eat. If I eat, I throw up. If I take the medications, I can eat, and I can take my insulin because I'm also an insulin diabetic. It is so drastic that I have this medication that all of my hospitalizations, I am escorted downstairs to medicate outside of the hospital doors by a security guard. The problem I'm having is I'm not being able to grow a garden by myself. I can't afford it. I live in a federally funded disabled apartment building. Can't have it there. And the different strains of medications, it doesn't matter how much you have, it's the quality of the medication that you have. If I have a good product, then maybe I'm only going to have to take it half of the day. If I have a bad product, you're not going to see me without a joint in my mouth because it takes that much to get my pain tolerance back down. I have a normal pain tolerance of about a 10 of a normal person, and that's a 5 for me on a normal day. Mm-hmm. Normally, it's even higher. So I'm not agreeing with some of the things, but I am agreeing that we need to get this 7-on-7 or 7-24 done because not only are we having problems with the law, but we're having problems with being attacked and getting written up by the law because 911 has come to take us to the hospital. And instead they're taking us to jail because we have maybe just cropped our garden and haven't been able to pass out medication to the other people, our excess. And that's a big problem. Because I know a lot of them that have been hurt in this situation, shot, taken to jail. If they're not taken to jail, then they're injured by the robber and nothing is done about it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Teresa Sheffer. I'm here for the same reason all of us are here, back here. I can say that I live in chronic pain every day, and I can say the medicine that we are allowed to have isn't enough, because I have to smoke from the time I get up in the morning pretty much till I go to bed to deal with chronic pain. I wished, you know, that the people that don't have to deal with pain could just, for one day, see what we go through. And maybe they would allow us, you know, to have an extra plant or something. As far as 8 pounds on a plant, I want that lady's number. Seriously, because I've never seen that before. Wow. That's about it. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Let me just go down the list, I guess. I have a meeting for 3. I have a meeting for 5. But I don't know. I know. I can't stop.
I'll be reading my statement. Thank you very much. Thank you for these hearings. I wanted to be here today to let you know how the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program...
Would you give us your name?
I'm sorry. My name is Jennifer Abood.
Jennifer, thank you.
I wanted to be here today to let you know how the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program has helped me first, let me describe my situation before I tell you the benefits of this program in medicine. I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1995 and experienced neuralgia and headaches with muscle problems. These attacks varied in length and severity. In the summer of the year 2000, my family and I were in a rollover car accident. We all survived, but my husband and I received severe injuries. In my case, I am now dealing with incomplete quadriplegia and a brain injury to my cerebellum. But what has resulted from this combination of health challenges is incomplete function of the nerves from the neck down and more muscle spasms, weakness, and paralysis on the left side than the right side. The unremitting neuropathic pain that accompanies these problems is difficult to put into words. The best description I can give is that it feels like when you bang your funny bone in your elbow or try to wake up a limb when it has gone numb or fallen asleep, that frostbite type of burning, throbbing, and buzzing as if there were red ants attacking can feel like forever. Then normally it goes away. Only in my case, it never leaves, ever, not for a moment. The pain, of course, is more intense and deeper than that, but it is an analogy everyone can relate to. I've also dealt with spasms, disorientation, dizziness, and problems with my stomach, just to name a few of the many, often overwhelming hardships that I've had to face each day. These challenges and devastating injuries have not only affected me, but my family also. I passed out a lot and had fits of anger and speaking gibberish. When I was taken off Neurontin, I was switched to Elevil, and that gave me nightmares and muscle stiffness that increased the longer I was using it. The pain medicine I was given from the doctors was OxyContin. I switched off that to phenylalanine with problems to my eyesight afterwards. I was running out of options and getting worse each day. I had been given so many prescriptions, the original amount when I left the hospital was 13. Trying to keep the drugs straight and enough food in me to function became impossible. My family was falling apart and couldn't see much of a future for me. My husband without a companion and my children without a mother. It would truly be tragic if this were the end of my journey, and all that I ever worked for or amounted to in my life left completely destroyed. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Program has truly been a lifesaver for me. My quality of life has moved from devastation to freedom. I have enjoyed consciousness and involvement in the daily activities and lives of my family once again. The horrifying pain is managed now, and I no longer talk of suicide or become so angry and unglued at the drop of a pin. When I was taking so many different pharmaceutical drugs, I was always nauseated and unable to eat very much. My physical therapist told me if I couldn't keep my weight up to 90 pounds, they wouldn't work with me and I wouldn't be rehabilitated. Since I have been taking cannabis in my food, I've been able to eat well and have not only gained weight, but have had a noticeable increase in muscle mass and strength. The dizziness, anxiety, depression, nightmares, and even some of the muscle stiffness have disappeared. I still take a pharmaceutical drug for the spasms and muscle tone, but that is the only other drug that I take. My quality of life has been greatly improved, and so I'm very grateful for my being able to participate in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. I first found out about the program from Stormy Ray one afternoon when we literally ran into each other at the health food store. Actually, I think she ran me down because she must have recognized how hard I was struggling to cope. I kept the pamphlet she gave me for almost a year before I called advice on how to apply. I was directed to the correct state agency and followed their directions. The doctor that signed my paperwork had never signed for another patient. After receiving my Oregon medical marijuana card in the mail, I wasn't sure how to proceed. Fortunately, I was able to contact the Stormy Ray Foundation again. They were supportive to me in every way. I was provided with medicine and never had to approach the black market for anything. It can be very difficult to start a garden up and learn how everything works. To be honest, I really have a hard time understanding the specifics of how to fully comply with all of the regulations and still have a consistent supply of cannabis. I want to be able to participate in the program and be a positive influence in my cardholder group and learn to help others the way that Stormy Ray and her foundation members have helped me. I have every confidence that the recommendations that she presents are well thought out and very necessary. I urge you to listen to her experience and adopt these recommendations to provide better service and protection for the law-abiding cardholders in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you. Ron Ayers, Muriel Hawkins. Greg Beyer. Now, I see you have written testimony, and I appreciate it if you could kind of summarize what you're going to present. Jennifer, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yes, Senator Morrison. I am Mary Louise Hockage, and I live here in Oregon, Salem, actually. I had the same story as everyone else, but I happen to be 72 years old, and I've had 15 years of misery. A year ago, a person said, try it. First night, 15 years of no sleep, I got sleep. I'm cutting down on all my pills, which consist of about 30. What is wrong with me will never go away. I am what I am. And I am now starting to live. I can crochet. I can do things that I have not done in years. And it is because of the marijuana.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Morissette. Members of the committee. My name is Kenneth Ruggie Byers. I live at 185 Yola Drive in Salem. I'm a U.S. citizen, honorably discharged from the U.S. Navy as a Vietnam veteran. I came back to Oregon and became a raised a family, earned a college degree, spent 24 years working as an employee and a good community member until I became too sick to do that anymore. I am not receiving any state or federal assistance. I would very much like to thank Senator Morissette for his efforts in seeking compromise and consensus in updating and improving patient access to the medical marijuana program. I'm here as a patient and a caregiver to ask support of Senate Bill 772. As an OMA patient, I'm using cannabis to help my nausea, pain, and muscle spasms related to irritable bowel and degenerative joint disease. It's apparent to anyone enrolled in the program that there are flaws in the initial law passed in 98. Many of these flaws are remedied in 772. Let's see. At this time, there's no limit on the number of patients that a grower can care for at one time. Limiting gardens, as in 772, to seven or some smaller number with seven distinct plants should make it very easy for law enforcement to be able to count up the correct number of plants available. I think each person should be in control of their own affirmative defense. It's better to be able to show that the law enforcement that you understand the law. 772 defines a viable plant. 24/7 makes it easy for law enforcement to verify. My own experience this last September was Polk County Sheriff's Department sent a interdiction helicopter, flew over my outdoor grow. Less than an hour later, they're at my doorsteps. They wanted my patient information. Well, after I told them that I was on the medical marijuana program and asked them if they had complied with the law and checked with DHS and the program, and they said, "What? What program?" Who, you know, they didn't know the law. They then asked for my identification, my patient's information, supplied them with what DHS gave me, and they said, well, where's your documentation? They wanted patient information, addresses, things like that. I told them HIPAA and patient confidentiality, you know, doesn't allow them that. 24/7 would certainly make it easier for them. The Oregon Health Plan already has the technology for the same thing. They have yes, no, pending. You call them up, that's what you get. It would be very easy to supply that same information to the law enforcement or the Department of Human Services for the same verification-type purposes. It really would be nice to have an administrative work group that regularly works to help the law stay moving forward, to stay malleable so that patients can see improvement with the law. We have a patient's bill of rights in the state. It was passed by legislators. The patients that are in medical marijuana don't receive the same benefits as a person that's on OxyContin or any other narcotic drug. It seems only fair to get it rescheduled so that it is medically acceptable and we can have some real dialogue on treatment for patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ron Ayers, did you come up?
I really wasn't going to say anything. I signed a piece of paper, but...
Ma'am, did you want to testify? Or, no, you're with...
Oh, I'm with my
Okay,
brother.
Good. Okay, good. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ron.
That's fine. I'm a patient. And the one thing that I ask, because I've been on both sides...
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Ron Ayers.
Okay.
And I'm a patient.
Good. That's fine.
I sat in on the advisory boards that sat around the table at the advisory board that you appointed. And the one thing I would ask, if you appoint another one, is that it be fair and impartial on both sides. Unfortunately, that was a train wreck before it even started for most people's attitudes. But as patients, we, as you've heard, as people talk, we've all got our specific little reasons for utilizing the medication. The laws are not clear. There's a lot of interpretation from the law enforcement people, and there's a lot of lack of education, as several people have brought up. All we ask as patients is that we be allowed to have our medications. And I can go into my history, but I won't, but I don't want to go back into pharmaceutical drugs. And there's so many of us like that. All we ask for is a fair understanding of the law, the people here, and so it can be interpreted. And I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris Rich and Hal Balford.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette, for sponsoring this bill. And I just want to say that your open-mindedness and sense of fairness is refreshing in a skeptical time.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, my name is Harold Ballard. I live in the Bethany area near Beaverton. As I said, your open-mindedness and sense of fairness is refreshing in a skeptical time, and I urge all patients and caregivers in your district to support you as long as you continue to run for office. Please don't let my casual appearance belie the seriousness of this issue for me. Some of the things that I've seen, to summarize what I see about 772, I think the best thing I see is the advisory committee that this law would establish. I've sat in on a number of the administrative work group sessions and participated in some of the successes, and there was a lot of collaboration going on, especially amongst those patient and caregivers that were supportive of the program and wanted to see it move forward. What's confusing to me is in Section 1, where number A says that you're allowed four immature plants in 1 ounce, and then B says you can use 7 plants of any maturity level and a total of 7 ounces. Section 2 insists that patients make a choice between B and C. So what happens to A? In other words, why do we even have A in there? It just seems to me to add another layer of confusion, because when law enforcement comes to my house and wants to know what kind of garden I have, do I have 3 plants? Do I have 7 plants? Do I have, 3 adults or 3 mature plants, that kind of thing. So I don't know how it would help them. Another problem I have is in Section 1.5 that defines that plants, the height of the plants up to 12 inches. As a grower, I can tell you I can have a plant that's 11 inches one night and 13 or 14 inches the next. So overnight, I can be out of compliance with this regulation. I am opposed to any absolution or any dissolvement, of the affirmative defense measure clause in this measure. Basically because of a personal experience, I was robbed last May, and the garden was broken into, destroyed, and because of the security where I had it, I have not been able to grow anymore. I have been working in other gardens, and as a result, I get to I do what we call greening. We do leafing the vegetables and the buds, the budding plants, and that material, while we heard references of up to 33%, mostly the vegetables, for example, will have 1 to 4% THC content. When I take that home, because it's wet, number one, I'm in, out of compliance because of the weight. Of course, I could argue that it's not usable marijuana if I were arrested. But what I do is I make canna butter, crock pot canna butter. I make can olive oil. It's a combination of olive oil and cannabis because cannabis is fat soluble. With those, I have one patient that uses my butter every morning because he has nerve pain. He lets the butter sit out and then he has it on toast and he feels better. Another patient is he's a 13-year-old boy. He's not my patient. He's his father's patient, but I provide him with the capsules. He doesn't take Ritalin anymore. He takes one capsule a day. He's not on the honor roll, but he's getting C's and D's in school, where he was just acting out totally. I also, because I'm an alcoholic, I don't. I make a glycerin tincture that, again, the cannabis is absorbed by the glycerin, so I'm able to use that in place of smoking at times because it provides quick relief. All those processes I told you about, for example, the canna butter, I use 4 ounces of butter for every pound of cannabis. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, just my point is, I don't want you to give up. I will not. I do not want to give up this protection. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Christopher Rich.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time. My name is Christopher Rich. I'm a registered caregiver with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. And I will begin with my fourth paragraph, okay, excluding my other three, since you have them on record to make light for time. I am a caregiver for 7 patients and can facilitate up to 10. The patients I aid otherwise would have no way to produce cannabis for medical use under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. A few of the patients I aid used to have to risk their freedom and property trying to obtain cannabis for lawful use. Many more registered patients have the same problem today. They have a card and benefit from cannabis, but no way to produce it or obtain a legal supply of the medicine. Of the 7 patients I currently produce for, 2 moved to the natural form of cannabis from Marinol. One reason is it simply costs too much money, and the second is that they can't control the dose because the synthetic drug is too powerful, rendering them unable to function. Another patient has decreased their pain pills by 30 a day, otherwise 900 a month, because of their lawful ability to use cannabis. Law enforcement has expressed a dislike for multiple patient gardens that serve these patients and multiple patient caregivers. After striking affirmative defense for caregivers like myself and OMA patients, would we be the first on their agenda? Based on law enforcement's logic, instead of having a secure facility with multiple patients taken care of, they would rather have hundreds more gardens sprout throughout the state. How would that be helpful to law enforcement and the patients who have their card but cannot obtain a legal supply of cannabis? Would they become prey? It is a shame that some have to break the law in order to follow another. More a shame if people follow all laws and still become prey to a loophole with no defense. In closing, the OMA should stay the same or should be minimally amended to protect patients with the following. Plant definitions, excuse me, increase plant limits to compensate for plant crop and failure. The inclusion of nurse practitioners and naturopaths to recommend medical cannabis. 24/7 verification of compliance for law enforcement. Designated facilities where valid patients can obtain a safe and legal supply of medical cannabis and reasonable compensation for competent caregivers. I thank the committee for their time.
Thank you very much, Christian. Thank you. Okay. Rachel. Yeah, I guess that's Rachel. Rachel Rose, Carla Harding, and Chris Iverson, please.
Rachel Rose, right up left.
Yeah.
I think Rachel has left. My name is Chris Iverson. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I am the new director of Voter Power. In 2004, Voter Power sponsored Measure 33, which would have fixed Oregon's medical cannabis laws. Measure 33 got over 750,000 votes statewide and received over 43% of the total vote. Oregon's largest county, Multnomah County, voted 56% in favor of Measure 33. Ladies and gentlemen, 750,000 votes means that the citizens of our great state have sent out a very clear and loud direct message to fix Oregon's medical cannabis laws. This is why we are here today. We, the citizens, are here to ask you for your help and to engage you in the process of democracy. There are three branches of the government that we must try and work with to pass better laws that will help many sick and dying people around Oregon. Today, we have chosen to meet with you good people and to ask for your help and assistance in this most important matter. Senate Bill 772 is a good bill, and voter power supports the proposed changes and improvements that are contained within SB 772. We support the current version of 772, and we are pleased that so much consensus has been built around the current version of this bill. However, voter power feels that the DAs and police might not support the current version of 772 as it does not eliminate the affirmative defense completely. The position of some law enforcement representatives that have been spoken to is that the AD must be eliminated or they will not support any effort to fix Oregon's medical cannabis laws. If this is true and the current version of 772 will end up going nowhere, then voter power feels it is in the best interest of progress to amend the current version of 772 to include the elimination of the AD. No one wants to give up the AD. This is a right for all patients and caregivers. We're not happy to do that, but we will if we get something good in trade. We understand the concept of horse trading. Within the medical cannabis community, there has been much discussion about the AD and its many benefits. Voter power acknowledges and agrees that the AD is a useful defense for people in certain situations. We would rather not eliminate the AD, but if it is the only way in which forward progress is to be made, then so be it. John Sejo, the executive director of Voter Power, has already explained our version of what we feel would be a more forward-thinking bill, so I won't reiterate what he said, but I will ask that you consider our position when you are at the point where changes and improvements can be made. It is our hope that working with the state legislature, we will accomplish much progress towards a more compassionate society. I sincerely hope that you will allow this to happen. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes. Just a comment. I'd respectfully point out that 1,021,814 Oregonians didn't agree with you, and I'm interested in making a good program, not horse trading. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Aaron Hildebrand, are you here? Jim Klar. Dr. Phil Levesque, would you please come up? Okay, and then we have Cliff Spencer, Stephen Dingle, and Christy Carrick. Left. Now, Dr. Levesque, you got to be brief.
Yes, sir. First of all, I'm Dr. Philip Levesque. Some of you may know that I have over 4,000 patients on medical marijuana, of which Mr. Bradshaw was one of those. He's probably one of the most severely damaged people that I've had, but over 4,000 people, I have seen some of the worst, sickest, most destitute patients in the state of Oregon. I'd like to correct a few definitions. There is no prescription for marijuana. There are no recommendations for dosage by a physician because a person may have a condition rated from 1 to 10. Therefore, there is also no dose. There is no frequency of use. You've heard some people say that they smoke marijuana all day. What we do need is a state standard. This has been, this was part of the Measure 33 last time we voted. We do know that the cannabinoids range from 4 or 5% up to 33%, but there is no standardization that we need this. We also need dispensaries of some sort. I've said that there are, that I have 4,000 patients. The marijuana office has accepted all of my applications. However, the Board of Medical Examiners revoked my license simply because I have 4,000 patients. There are a total of about 11,000 marijuana patients whose applications were signed by 1,500 doctors in Oregon. And in the past 2 years, 500 more doctors have come aboard for this expanding group. However, 10 physicians have signed 70% of the applications. Dr. Spokas of the Board of Medical Examiners said to me, asked me, did I know that marijuana was both addicting and very dangerous? It is probably less addicting than Starbucks coffee and is far less dangerous than aspirin. There are two major problems with this program. Many police departments ignore the Oregon law allowing medical patients to grow and use marijuana. This has been mentioned several times today. Secondly, and because of the police, many patients are afraid to grow their own medicine for fear of arrest. The Oregon program is one of the most successful in the United States and is the model for almost every other state. We are getting approximately 100 new applications per week for patients so they can use it legally. Marijuana is good, safe medicine. It has been used for 5,000 years and has never caused a death, which is more than you can say even for aspirin or coffee.
Dr. Levecki, yes, sir. Summarize.
Yes, sir. Medical marijuana usage is saving the Oregon Health Plan millions of dollars per year. It is also saving lives, patients' lives, and large amount of money they would be spending on morphine-like prescriptions. Anything you can do to improve this problem will be a blessing to many patients. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you.
Good afternoon, senators. My name is Erin Hildebrandt, and I am a wife, mother of five, and patient in the OMMP program. I hope that you'll take the time to read my written testimony, and I'd just like to add, just go over a couple of things very quickly. Bottom line for me, I don't know about the person who grew an 8-pound plant, but I'm not that good at this. I killed my first two plants that I tried to grow, and boy, I've given it a real good effort since then, but I'm not coming up with anything like that. I mean, I'll be happy if I get an ounce. growing the plants indoors, it just, you don't see that kind of yield from a plant. This isn't like tomatoes in the windowsill. This is more like an exotic plant because we're trying to create medicine. We're not just trying to create food to sustain ourselves. The medicine takes a little more specific techniques to learn how to get good at growing it. If you're looking for any kind of a federal guideline here, I would suggest that you look at the Federal Investigational New Drug Program.
I'm going to go in just a minute.
They are currently giving seven patients, at the federal level, they are dispensing to seven patients over 6 pounds of marijuana every year. They dispense it to them in little round tins, and they dispense it in the most dangerous form that they know. They roll it into cigarettes for them. And it would seem to me, if we're looking at protecting the health and well-being of patients, we should first and foremost tell them there are safer ways to consume marijuana than by smoking it. But our own federal government will only give it to patients legally, seven patients, in the most dangerous form they know of. I don't know that I would suggest going with the federal guidelines because of that, but certainly the 6-pound limit seems that they have set an amount that they feel is fair and reasonable. I would also just like to say that since I don't think any of you really have a goal here of chasing down the small-time crooks who might scam this program, I think we can all agree that there are more important things like rape and murder that go unsolved and under-investigated that we'd all like to see resolved more than chasing down stoners. Just please err on the side of patience here and give us the benefit of the doubt, because a couple more plants in my garden may mean the difference between me eating and not. A couple more plants in my garden isn't going to pose any realistic risk to the citizens of Oregon. And lastly, the other point that I'd like to bring up is the affirmative defense. I would beg of you to please. I agree with the 772 in allowing people an option. If they want to sign away their right to an affirmative defense, I have no problem with that. It's like if someone wants to sign away their Miranda rights. sure, if they want to, go for it. But I have a problem with taking that right away from people, especially people who aren't here today to speak to you. So thank you very much.
I am sorry that I have to leave because I have a pre-arranged appointment and Jeff is co-chair. I'm sorry. Senator Cruz is the vice chair and he will take over. And Senator Starr, you will be around for a few minutes. We're almost finished with the hearing. And I appreciate everyone being here. And I'm sorry that I do have to leave after this. Now, he hasn't had much experience as a chair, so please be patient with him, please. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Senators, my name is Clifford Spencer. Please excuse the abbreviated oral presentation of this two-page testimony. On Monday, September 6, 2004, Dr. Rick Baer sent a letter via email to Dr. Higginson, state health officer, who convened the Legislative Advisory Committee, requesting clarification changes to the, quote, potential consensus changes, parentheses, House Bill 772. Or if changes weren't considered, he requested the letter be added as an addendum. This letter was signed by most medical marijuana proponents, including myself. I'll clarify the second change requested in this letter and why it's needed. I'll also clarify why it's important for patients who are incapable of self-medicating to be accommodated by the proposed change in 475.2282A, as included in SB 772. And last, I'll explain why we need to clarify definition of a plant in OMA. Although I'm a medical marijuana patient myself with four herniated discs and symptoms associated with that condition, I'm here to give you perspective from my volunteer work. With several others, I coordinate assisting patients who are in residential care, people too sick or physically challenged to live on their own, with implementation of OMA. This involves assisting patients through the application process, working with doctors, nurses, social workers, psychologists, and facility administrators to coordinate efforts with this treatment modality. With documenting medicine dispense, we do an in-depth follow-up of what symptoms are being addressed and the efficacy of this medicine. Residential facilities have their own challenges to patients' implementation of OMA. For the most part, patients in residential care are indigent. Again, residential care facility patients are too ill or physically challenged to live on their own. Residential care facilities' fire laws prohibit patients from using lighters or matches in their rooms, and the OMA prohibits medicating in a public place. So to overcome this hurdle, we've devised alternative delivery methods like vaporizing, baked goods, cannabis capsules, to name a few. In residential care, nurses ultimately are liable civilly, criminally, and in professional and facility licensing for anything that happens to a patient in their care. For example, if a patient in a residential care facility is under the care of these nurses, is on morphine, goes off the premises and consumes alcohol and ODs, ultimately these nurses are liable. And likewise, nurses in licensed health care facilities feel they're liable for any repercussions of a patient in their care who uses medical marijuana. Although OMA includes protections for doctors, it includes no protections for nurses in licensed health care facilities who are much more vulnerable. In the Legislative Advisory Committee, convened by Dr. Higginson on Senator Morissette's request, law enforcement stated no objections to these protections for healthcare professionals and licensed healthcare facilities. In the past 6 years of assisting patients in residential care with OMA implementation, I've had 17 patients pass away. Some patients are in end-stage AIDS. Some patients are in end-stage liver failure from Hep C. Some are end-stage cancer, and so on and so forth.
Could you kind of summarize, please, where you're at your limit that the senator put on for testimony?
Okay. Well, let me just read to you the proposed changes for two out of these three. And I'm going to quote a rewrite of 475.328-2A. A licensed health care professional may administer medical marijuana to a registered patient currently residing in a licensed care facility if the administration of pharmaceuticals is consistent with the professional scope of practice. Neither a facility where an LMP patient resides nor any employee volunteer of that facility is liable civilly, criminally, professionally through loss of licensure for a patient using medical marijuana under the LMP. Administration may not be in a public place as defined by ORS 161.015, must not expose individuals under 18 years old, and if inhaled, must provide for adequate ventilation. Nothing in this section requires a licensed healthcare professional to administer medical marijuana. Thank you.
Thank you very much. excuse me. Christy Carrick, Lena Berger, and Casey Ferguson. These two. Good afternoon. We'll let you start. State your name and.
My name is Christy Carrick. I am not a cannabis user, but have seen the medicinal benefit that medicinal cannabis has for patients. Currently, there are, well, I'm not sure of the exact facts, but about 3.5 million Oregonians, and we have 10,000 registered patients on the OMMP program. There are more patients I know that for whom cannabis brings relief and improves the quality of life who are unregistered patients. Why are they unregistered? They really don't know about the OMMP at all, or they have misinformation about the qualifying conditions. They are afraid to be in a database because of the current federal law, and they don't know how to go about getting their card, and they're afraid of the social stigma. The current laws for cultivating and possessing cannabis are very harsh outside of the OMMA. A patient who receives relief from cannabis receives these benefits regardless of any law we may pass or may not pass. These sick Oregonians need the protection of the affirmative defense from the very harsh penalties associated with cannabis use. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Gentlemen, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Casey Ferguson, and I'm from Eugene. I am a regular volunteer at the Compassion Center of Eugene, which maintains the OMA records for about 1,400 patients. I myself am not a patient, nor am I a user, but I do see the benefits from patients that come in there. To get past one of the main problems that I've seen being addressed here today, which is the number of plants and where a plant would actually be considered a plant rather than a seedling. I would like to explain what other counties and in California have done to overcome this. Federal law says that you're not allowed to have over 100 plants, which in excess of 100 or more plants would become a federal, not a state jurisdiction law. And what they did is they will allow up to 99 plants, but they limit the canopy coverage to a 10 by 10 area, which a 10 by 10 area with 99 plants would be about this tall. Mm-hmm. So that is one solution that I'm presenting to you to be able to get past the numbers issues and the lines, and we'll be able to establish a definite line for law enforcement agencies to be able to come in, and all that they need is a tape measure to see if you are in compliance, regardless of maturity of the plants or if they are a seed. There will be no discretion with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Cruz, Senator Starr, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I helped draft ballot measure 33. I serve on the Board of Directors of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers and am their liaison to the Legislative Committee. OCDLA and I both support 772, although I have concerns as currently drafted. And mostly, Senator Cruz, they're in response, I think, to your comments in response to Mr. Iverson's testimony. The concern I have is that any well-intentioned, thorough reform of the Medical Marijuana Act to really be effective has to win. I mean, we tried in Measure 33 to draft a law that would make sure that there was an adequate supply of medicine for patients, and to make sure that there was adequate access, improved access to the program, and we were, as you point out, unsuccessful at the polls. The problem with 772 as currently drafted is that law enforcement opposes it, and as I understand the political realities in this building, it can pass out of this chamber but won't get a hearing in the other chamber. And that really what was the sticking point in the conversations that we had in the Legislative Advisory Committee with law enforcement was the affirmative defenses. Toward that end, I've drafted, well, let me back up a half a step. You've heard from lots of people, some of whom are lawyers, some of whom aren't, some of whom provided you accurate information, and some of whom didn't. I can tell you that I practice statewide defending medical marijuana patients. I've appeared in 16 counties, and it's primarily the work that I do. And there are three, actually, affirmative defenses, and they affect three classes of patients. The 772 addresses the first class, the registered patients who has too much, but the other classes are people who didn't register because they didn't, for whatever reason, or didn't register because they could not. And I had reached out to Mark McDonald, who I think has left, but he was here earlier. He's the...
Are you still here?
He's hiding behind Mr. Dingell. I drafted a letter I sent to Mr. McDonald. Jim Klar from Oregon Green Free and I met with Mr. McDonald in December to discuss a possible compromise on this issue, and I drafted a letter that I sent to him that I shared with Benton County District Attorney Scott Heiser, who is the Oregon District Attorney Association's person on 772, and I also faxed it to Craig Durbin. And we have, our organization has a lobby day on Friday, or on Wednesday of next week, and as Chair Marsetz indicated that there'll be another hearing on the 24th, I guess what I'll do is I'll just try and come visit each of you, on the 17th and discuss this with you further. But my concern is that in crafting a bill that amends the Medical Marijuana Act, that we're able to get a bill that not only passes out of this committee and passes out of this chamber, but can pass out of the other chamber and be signed by the governor.
Okay, and if you have proposed amendments, if you can get them to the administrator so we can have them in the mix when we're going to work.
Well, what I did was I wrote up a one-page cover sheet to the letter that I've described, and the specific suggestions are included in there. And as I've indicated, I will try and come see various members of the committee, and I can try and come see you too. Let's try and come see the administrator as well.
Okay. We do have that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Please.
Steve Dingell.
Actually, if I could, I did want to, in addition to thanking Senator Morissette for sponsoring the legislation, I did want to express my appreciation for the Oregon Medical Cannabis Alliance for its hard work in presenting the bill, and especially the hard work of Dr. Baer, of Madeline Martinez from Oregon Normal, and of Brian Michaels, who previously testified. Thank you very much.
Higgins. Yeah. Steve Dingell and Walter Higgins. This will be the last panel of the day. So,
good morning. Thank you, sir.
Please give us your name. And
my name is Walter Hagen, and I'm a disabled veteran. I'm chaplain for the Blind Veterans Association, the Lower Columbia region here in Oregon. And I'm also a medical marijuana patient. And if it wasn't for Stormy Ray and several other people helped me get onto this program, I wouldn't be here. I've had a double bypass, and I was rushed back into the hospital and had to have an artificial aorta put in after a blood clot. And then I had part of my left lung removed, and I was ready to go back to work, and by golly, I started losing my sight. And I've got a rare eye disorder. I've lost this total sight in my left eye. I've got about 8% sight left in my right eye, and I have a rare eye disorder. It's called optic nerve drusens. And it's something that cannot be cured. One in a million people ever get it. and I happen to be the lucky one. But with this medication, it has helped me so much. And being visually impaired, it's hard for me to tell what size a plant is. And if I could just feel it, if it's a foot by a foot, I go along with Stormy Ray's recommendations on the size of the plant. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Vice Chairman Cruz. Steve Dingell from the Marion County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. We do oppose the bill in the form that it is now, and I realize the hour is late, so what I would request is permission to submit them some things in writing. Nobody disputes some of the things that you've heard up here, but the reality is that there are people who use this law to illegally manufacture, illegally distribute, and illegally sell marijuana. It is just that simple. And if you, there was a recent large article or series of articles in the Oregonian, which I believe have been reprinted into one format. As I read that, it dealt with methamphetamine, and it pointed out a very interesting phenomenon, which in law, as the person responsible for supervising all the drug prosecutions in Marion County, I've seen time and time again. With methamphetamine, every effort that was made to regulate the raw material resulted in the people who were manufacturing being one step ahead of the regulator. I don't want to rain on people's parades, but I can tell you right now that the bill as drafted is rife for abuse. It will make, in my estimation, it will make it virtually impossible to prosecute people who are doing things outside the act. And I would point out to you that a lot of the people that you're seeing today are never going to be contacted by law enforcement. But when you look at, just do a little math with some of these numbers. For example, 28 plants at one time, 80 ounces per patient, you run out the numbers, that's 3.5 pounds of marijuana. There's no requirement that they tell the health division when they start. There's absolutely no way that law enforcement has any way of knowing whether the crop they're looking at is the first crop, the second crop, or the 10th crop of the year. Changing the definition of that plant, that's no accident. They've created a third category of plant. There would be no prohibition to having 1 million seedlings. There's no prohibition. They're not illegal. You can have 1 million of them. And remember that those 1 million seedlings are just, as you've heard from the people who grow, not very far away from turning into plants. Those are just some of the issues, and I know the hour's late. I would ask, Chairman, if I could submit some things in writing on behalf of our association. Thank you.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much. I want to thank everybody for their patience, and I also want to, we have written testimony received, I think all committee members have it, from John English, who's director for our children's children, and it's submitted for the record and in everybody's packet. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 772, and we are adjourned.